Call the House Committee on Health Care to order and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2118. Madam Administrator, can you give us a brief review on 2118? Not the whole one.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2118 comes to you from the Governor's Office. It contains many components, but all components of the bill relate to health professional regulatory boards. It talks about impaired professionals. Mr. Chair, I'm not even going to begin to go through it. I'll let the department or the governor's office go through it, if you don't mind. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Ms. Black, will you join us to start this process along?
Nope.
I'd be happy to.
You want to bring along somebody to protect you?
I do.
Governor's deputy counsel.
You bring your counsel with you. I think this is going
to... Does she need to stand Hooray. In front or behind
her? I don't know. I think you need to be careful and check with her before you answer any of our questions.
Mr. Chair, it was my understanding that you might want the report on the Oregon Health Licensing Agency before we began.
Only if it's very brief.
I think it will be very brief.
Okay.
Okay, enough. She's done.
You're done. What is that thing?
That's why. You
want to start a new band? I know
Isn't
it's Red
it?
Day, but that's taking it far out.
He valet parked all of our cars today, Mr. Chair.
Very brief.
Let's go. Point, are you now aware of heart disease?
Okay. Right. Yeah, but this is modest and reasonable. Let's go quickly. Please.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. I'm Chris Couts, and I'm the Deputy Director at the Department of Administrative Services, and I understand you would like a brief overview of what's happening at the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. So,
very brief, so my administrator doesn't kill me.
Yes, I understand, sir. So early last week, we had, based on complaints that were received at the Department of Justice and through the Secretary of State's Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Hotline, the Department of Administrative Services met with the agency administrator and Department of Justice to determine, based on the veracity of those complaints, that one of the managers within the organization needed to be placed on administrative leave and we needed to start an assessment at the organization. Later in the week, through discussions with SEIU representing the staff at the organization, meetings at the governor's office, and with staff over the weekend, on Monday there were additional decisions made to place an additional 3 managers and 2 representative employees on administrative leave. As a result of those decisions, we have brought in 3 managers from the Department of Administrative Services to run the organization, to help with the ongoing assessment that is currently happening within the organization, take a look at the business processes, the fiscal issues, and to continue to take a look at the organizational issues that are there. The Department of Justice is conducting an assessment, is currently meeting with staff that are inside the organization. They will also be meeting with staff that have left the organization, and they will meet with those that are placed on administrative leave. We expect the assessment to take 2 to 3 weeks. At that time, once we have the information and the data, we will then make the appropriate decisions based on whether or not the allegations were substantiated and corroborated through the assessment process.
Good. And the reason I thought this was relevant to the bill we're going to be hearing now has to do with the ability to deal with a problem that arose. I don't think we need to get into the issues of that. I hope you'll keep us informed on that as
sure.
we think about how to deal with these. But one of the issues in 2118 that Ms. Black will be talking about a bit is the ability to have the executive director of boards serving at the pleasure of the governor. And this was a situation where you were able to deal with what was the problem, and I don't know what the problem is, nor does anybody else here. But you were able to deal with it quickly and effectively because you were able to at least deal with that manager in that context. Is that?
Chair Greenlake, the executive director of the Oregon Health Licensing Agency is appointed by the director of the Department of Administrative Services. So given that tie, when we receive the complaint at the Department of Administrative Services, we can very quickly, because we have the resources within state government, to take action and not only to deal with the issues at hand, but if additional managers, as in this case, need to come into the organization, we can quickly identify those and the next day have those people in place. When you have boards and commissions, I've been involved in those issues with other agencies that have gone through troubled times, and sometimes that process gets a little lengthened out because as you deal with private sector people who are volunteering as board members, they have to get up to speed on what the issues are, how to treat the employees. They usually do that with legal counsel. It can be a longer process. It doesn't necessarily have to be, but it can be.
Okay. Are there any questions? Not counting any of about the substance of what went on. I suppose we'll hear about that. There were some newspaper stories. We didn't get them printed on this, but we will get them to the committee in case you haven't seen them.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, actually, I do have one question. Just to alleviate something that's been haunting me is the public been compromised in this? I say the customers, the professionals that are under this licensing agency, have they been compromised?
Chair Greenlake and Representative Maurer, that is one of the issues that is being assessed, is overall what's happening in the organization and has there been any impact on the public or not?
Okay. That's fair enough. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Back to the substance of 2119.
No.
2118, I'm sorry. Ms. Black?
Thank you, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee. My name is Claudia Black, and I'm Governor Kulongoski's Health and Human Services Policy Advisor. And with me is Amber Hollister, the Governor's Deputy Legal Counsel, and she's on hand to answer any legal questions you may throw my direction. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about this bill. I'm here to support House Bill 2118 with the Dash 1 amendments, and I hope you all have copies of those. We would have liked to have incorporated these amendments into the bill, but we didn't have the opportunity to do so before it was printed. This bill was introduced on behalf of the governor and will bring oversight and transparency to the administration of the state's many health professional licensing boards. It will also provide the boards with the tools to help them become more effective and efficient in carrying out their mission. This bill was created over the past year with input from the governor, from legislators, board executives, health professional associations, and other interested parties. And some of the components in this bill mirror or are similar to other bills that this committee has already heard. This bill makes several important changes in the laws governing the boards. Where such statutes exist in individual boards, House Bill 2118 will apply them uniformly. The first thing that happens in the bill is that it clarifies that all health regulatory agencies have as their primary mission promoting, and this is a direct quote from the bill, promoting quality and protecting the public health, safety, and welfare by ensuring that licensees practice with professional skill and safety. House Bill 2118 declares that all board members and executive directors shall serve at the pleasure of the governor. The governor is responsible for the actions of the board and therefore must have the authority to act quickly when problems do arise. I think that the issue of executive directors serving at the pleasure of the governor is probably the most contentious in the bill. Yet we believe that it's critical that the governor have this authority. When serious problems arise, acting promptly is essential to making sure that the work of the board continues without interruption. House Bill 2118 also extends to all boards the authority to request fingerprints for anyone applying for or renewing a license, as well as for current employees, applicants for employment, and volunteers. Some of the boards have this authority now, others don't. Health professionals will also be required to report any licensee who may be professionally incompetent, guilty of unprofessional or dishonorable conduct, or impaired. And we've already had a few discussions about this, who the licensee reports to, which board they report to. And we recently had a conversation right before the hearing with the Oregon Medical Association saying they'd like to work with us a little bit on modifying that. We're certainly open to it. And then anyone reporting another licensee in good faith is immune from civil liability. Bill also requires, this is a pretty lengthy bill, it also requires that when a licensee is investigated, that public members of the board actually be involved in the board review of investigatory information and the report. Yet another improvement in this bill, it allows board jurisdiction over licensees to be maintained in two important situations. One is when the license of a licensee under investigation lapses. Currently, some boards, if a licensee is under investigation and the license expires, the licensee is no longer under control of the board and the investigation must cease. If the licensee later reapplies for a license, critical information may be missing. The other situation involves professionals who register with a board voluntarily, such as social workers or counselors and therapists. And often they'll do that because they get reimbursement. Under current law, someone in this situation could have their license revoked by a board and continue to practice. And this is something that's been brought up by the Board of Social Workers and the counselors and therapists where they revoked a license for something such as sexual misconduct and the person's allowed to continue to practice. Licenses are only revoked for serious offenses, and this board would allow the board to prevent the person from practicing without a license. There's also a provision that allows the former licensee to reapply in the future if they've resolved those issues that caused the revocation of their license initially. Now, probably all of you are pretty aware of some of the issues with the Board of Nursing, and I've had numerous discussions both with staff at the Board of Nursing and executive directors over the last probably 6 or 8 months about how we could have prevented this situation from occurring. What we discussed is basically the need for a program audit, and we talked about how to best accomplish it. So what the bill has, what the Dash 2-1 amendment has in it, is a peer review process that would allow three executive directors and a public board member to go to a licensing board and essentially to do a program audit.
I'm sorry, do we have those Dash 1 amendments yet?
Yes.
We do?
I don't.
We don't.
I don't have them.
Okay. Tom Burns from your office gave them to me about a week and a half ago.
Gave them to you?
Yes.
Yeah. And then?
Well, and then I've been using them.
Okay. Would you like to share them with us, too?
I would be delighted to share them with you.
Although you're going to have some Dash 2s, right? Is that right?
We are going to have some Dash 2s.
Okay.
So they're not a secret.
And, and the Dash 2s will include the Dash 1s?
If that's your pleasure, absolutely.
I'm sorry. What is this I have in front of me?
Oh, we can discuss it later.
Right.
Well, it's just for us.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Okay.
You are proposing some Dash 1s.
We're proposing Dash 1s. In the Dash 1s, which you will be having a copy of very soon, we are proposing that a peer review process be started where three executive directors from other health-related licensing boards and one public board member go into a board and review their files and check for people being on discipline, if they're being contacted regularly, investigations are current, licenses are being issued in a timely manner, and so forth. And they'll also be able to give them advice on how they might streamline and make their processes more efficient. This is something that the executive directors themselves came up with, and I think it's an excellent idea. It adds accountability and transparency to the board review process by involving those who really know the process the best. Finally, House Bill 2118 will make emails obtained through online licensing process unavailable as public records. This will allow the boards to continue the new and efficient method of online licensing without confidentiality concerns. These are pretty much the highlights of the bill. Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, I urge you to support 2118 with the...
Dash one and dash two amendments.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I've asked the executive directors who have a particular interest in one of the areas on the bill to come forward and testify so that you don't hear a lot of testimony that is repetitive.
Sort of. Okay. Excellent. But let's talk about questions from you to begin. Mr. Representative Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Claudia, you and I, when we met in my office earlier, we talked a little bit about how those three peers in the, and maybe it's clarified in the Dash 1 Amendment, we haven't seen that yet, how those three peers in a peer review will be selected. Who selects them and how are they selected? Has that been determined yet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin, I appreciate that you'd asked me that question earlier so I had a chance to think about it, but it will be through the rules promulgated by DAS, Department of Administrative Services.
Okay. Representative Garrett, was that you?
No.
Somebody down here. Mm-hmm. I do want to note we have two bills in front of us that, at least two, in fact, there are a few more, but we have, what is the number, 2059 that Representative Garrett is working on that talks about when one professional needs to report some activities in the second professional. Very similar to yours, and you're going to be working with him. We may be able to deal with that and solve it here rather than in that other bill, but we will be talking about it. I also want to note that the request of that Claudia went over very quickly, the request that the licensed clinical social worker board and the counselor board has is the same request that we have in a bill for the direct entry midwives, where these are three examples where somebody can perform as a professional without seeking license or certification, but can also seek license and certification. So somebody gets an MSW from Portland State, they can become a social worker and they can go off and counsel patients and things like that. But they can also seek an LCSW, a licensed clinical social worker, which requires 2 years of supervised practice and a variety of things. So what this bill would do, it would say somebody could practice as a social worker, given their MSW or maybe even a BSW. If they apply to become a licensed clinical social worker and they get that license taken away, the board could stop them from doing what they could do without having applied for that license. We have the same thing with direct entry midwives and the same thing with counselors. I think that raises some significant issues we need to talk about, and we will talk about it as we process this. But if we decide this is the right thing to do, again, I think we can amend this vehicle and do it for the direct entry midwife so we don't have to deal with that as a separate bill as well. And I think, Claudia, it would be basically the same language. You just have to add another statute to it. Is that how it would work?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe we could do that. When Tom Burns and I spoke to Ted Rettlinger from Legislative Council earlier, he also suggested that maybe we would want to include an amendment that said for people who obtain new licenses or who renew their licenses so that as people are doing that, they understand what the ramifications of it are.
Yeah, I mean, I think this would be a shock right now to people with this. But at any rate, I just wanted to note those because we'll be dealing with those. And I also want to note if somebody doesn't get a chance to testify in this bill today, we'll be happy to accept, as in any other case, when we hold this over, we'll be happy to accept written testimony from people beyond today's session. We were asked that question. Any other questions before we move on?
If you're not interested in this one.
You didn't even need your sidekick there. But thank you very much for coming with us.
Thank you, Chair Greenlake.
A lot of questions if she had a opinion.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
No, I just wanted to note that. Yeah, I have a question about that, actually. I mean, I have a substantive question. It seems very odd for me to, let's take a social worker. I'll pick on social workers because everybody knows how much I like them. They won't mind. I mean, we have a social worker who does something bad who is not an LCSW, we don't have any authority over that person. Now, maybe we should. Maybe we should have a practice act and make all social workers become LCSWs before they can do clinical practice. But right now, we don't. So we have social workers out there who can do whatever they want, but if they become an LCSW and they screw up, then we can say, no, you can't do what you could have done without having applied for a license. That seems odd to me.
It does, but that...
And it's only these three because they don't have practice acts. They only have, what do you call it, title protection or something?
But that's not what this addresses.
That is what that addresses.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair. The
bullet says it is.
The bullet that he is, or we're cryptically talking about, is third from the bottom of your little handout, House Bill 21.
One-page sheet.
Allowing a board to maintain jurisdiction over a licensee under investigation whose licensee is no longer in effect. And I believe there were some circumstances where the...
Oh, yeah. There are two parts to that.
And I was focused on the other part.
It's the second part I was... Yeah, no, the first part is you put me under investigation and I say I'll voluntarily drop my license and you... That ends the investigation under current bill.
Exactly.
And this would deal with that. I don't have any question about that.
Okay.
It's a question I have about the... And that would hold for any board now, right? Not just for these two.
We're having a cryptic conversation. Example is, you're picked up for DUI. Before the next day drops, you say you surrender your license. That would terminate a board's ability to continue investigation because you are no longer a licensee because you voluntarily surrendered your license.
That's right.
We're stopping that. An example where it doesn't work that way is TSPC, a teacher. Even if you surrender, you've done something bad, surrender your license, the investigation can follow you even after you surrender your license, because clearly...
And so can the penalties.
Okay, so can the penalties. But we want to stop that to give the boards the authority to continue the investigation.
That's right. That's the first part. And the second part is this other piece.
Okay.
And I don't have any question at all on the first piece.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Slightly and a different piece of this. I just wondered, what are the provisions that this bill standardizes for membership and appointment of health professional regulatory boards?
What are the...
Right here in the next...
You're asking what sections of the statutes?
Well, I'm asking what are the standardizations. Is this a duplicate of the other that was going to add public members and some of that?
It's not a duplicate. It's if we pass this, we still have the other. This, for example, with public board members, simply says there must be a minimum of two public board members. We
so it does
about
say two,
more than that. And it says all the board members shall be appointed by the governor and serve at his pleasure. That's similar to what we have in that. What's different here is the executive directors, which will be appointed by the board, supervised by the board, but serve at the pleasure of the governor. That's what's different about this bill from many of the bills we have. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. The other piece that's missing is that I believe that one of your bills requires Senate confirmation
of the
board members, and this doesn't include
that. But that would still be consistent with this. We pass this, and then we pass that. That would be completely consistent.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Who have we got, Madam Administrator? Why don't you call who you think ought to be called?
No, you
don't. Okay.
Slippery slope there.
I've got here in a weakened state. Okay, who do we have? We have Becky Eklund, Michelle Gaines. Who else, ma'am?
Patty Glenn.
I see, Patty Glenn, right. Come on, y'all. Here's three. Okay. Any order.
I'll start. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Becky Eklund. I'm the executive director for the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists. And I am here to to talk to the committee specifically about the amendments in Section 2 of the bill. As you discussed with Claudia a few minutes ago, counselors and therapists are not required to be licensed in Oregon. We do have about 2,500 licensees, and they are licensed on a voluntary basis. The board has authority over those licensees but does not have authority over counselors or therapists who are not licensed. And I could be a counselor or therapist, or any of you could be a call yourselves a counselor or a therapist, as long as you do not use the title licensed. So, as Chair Greenlick talked about social work, someone with a social work degree, in this case, a person wouldn't have to have any degree and they could become a counselor, if anybody would go to them.
What do you mean? I have my colleagues coming to me all the time. I have a little shingle out. It doesn't say licensed or registered.
I think that's what we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, that's not what I was talking about. I would like to provide a recent example that this board dealt with in connection with the provision that talks about revoked licensees and prohibiting continued practice by that licensee. We had a complaint in 2008 about a licensed counselor who'd seen a mother and her six-year-old daughter because the daughter had been talking to the mother about being sexually abused by her stepfather. So the counselor met with the mother and the little girl, and sometimes with the stepfather, and the counselor decided the little girl was not telling the truth. As a result, the mother would admonish the girl whenever she would talk about it, saying, you know that's not true, so don't talk about it anymore. Well, not only did the counselor lead the parents to believe that hadn't happened, she did not report it to the authorities. So it was not until 3 years later the little girl told a friend of hers about the sexual abuse. School authorities then reported it to the police, and their investigation turned up with the stepfather confessing to that sexual abuse of that little girl. So the little girl was subjected to 3 more years of abuse from that stepfather. If the counselor initially had reported it, that may have been prevented. So there's nothing prohibiting at this point in time that counselor to continue to be out there counseling people. And this provision in Section 2 of the with the amendments would prevent that sort of thing happening. And as a matter of fact, this particular counselor is still practicing, and she's a counselor at a middle school. I'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michelle Gaines, and I am the executive director of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. We regulate the facilities and practitioners in the death care industry, which is a segment of health that is often overlooked or avoided because of death and its consequences. The truth is, health is a broad life cycle with many aspects and practitioners that require highly specialized skills, tools, practices, and knowledge. In this, we are far from interchangeable. A clinical social worker may be ill-suited to prepare a body for viewing. A veterinarian may be ill-suited to provide speech therapy to my daughter's best friend. And I am absolutely the last person you would want to pull a tooth. And yet...
I don't know, we have to check with Mr. Breath about that.
At the end of the day, there are many objectives that we in healthcare have in common. We do no harm. We implement standards and controls that protect the welfare, safety, and health of those we serve directly, but also each and every individual surrounding those that receive care. We have high standards, and rightly so. House Bill 2118-1 recognizes the fact that while we maintain different sets of regulatory and licensing requirements, there are clear standards of transparency and review that should be met. It recognizes that boards in their membership should represent the full diversity of our state in all its aspects, as well as the specialized expertise required to regulate and enforce in our unique industries. It addresses certain standards for all licensees in the health life cycle to ensure consistent levels of protection that not only protect all persons, but ultimately help maintain the integrity of all healthcare professions by strengthening each board's ability to prevent those who shouldn't be practicing from causing any level of harm. It holds agency heads accountable to our dual role, to uphold the laws, policies, and operations overseen by our boards, as well as to meet the standards of practice as part of a larger entity, to fulfill our commitment as public servants, to bring standards of operational excellence, fiscal responsibility, and quality to bear in the delivery of state government. On behalf of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, as a health licensing practitioner focused on the end of the life cycle, and as a member of the health-related licensing boards, I would like to register my support for the spirit and the scope of House Bill 2118.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick.
Oh, are there any questions? I'm sorry. Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I am also here to speak specifically to the Section 2 of the of 2118. Just another example to support the idea of continued jurisdiction. There are a few of the health boards that have Practice Act in place that do not have a continued jurisdiction component. And as an example, in the massage board, a year ago we received a final notice or final order from a criminal case which required a surrender of a license. The individual had sexually assaulted one of his clients while engaged in the performance of massage, but that complaint was never reported to the board, so the board was unaware of that until we received the final criminal documentation. Unfortunately, that individual's license had lapsed 30 days prior to the date. So in our system, and as far as the members of the state of Oregon are concerned, the public information shows him as a lapsed licensee, not as someone who would have been suspended or revoked for extremely inappropriate behavior. Likewise, we are therefore not able to report that nationally or to our sister states across the country so that they can address this if this individual were to apply for a license with them. So we do ask you to support Section 2 of 2118. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Just ask a question. On your particular case, if you were to reapply for his license now, would the investigation continue, or once it's expired and have to have new cause to, there'd have to be new cause to require an investigation?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, Representative Bruin.
I'm afraid I didn't ask you to identify yourself.
I am so sorry. Patty Glenn, Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists, for the record. In that case, we would look at that criminal history as a condition of renewing the license, so we would be able to take it into consideration for the renewal.
In that particular case, there's a criminal history that goes...
Yes, there's a criminal history that we'd be able to consider.
I mean, there's
that is demonstrably...
Okay.
Absolutely. Thank you. Sorry, sir.
We're under some real time pressure, so thank you very much. There are two people who have signed up to testify in opposition to this, and I'd like to call them. No, I don't want them to feel we've squeezed them out, because we are going to be squeezing time. And that's, who do we have? Wes Werpahl and Scott Nearing.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Wesley Werpahl. I'm an optometric physician practicing here in Salem, and I currently serve as Vice President of the Oregon Board of Optometry. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you here today. The Oregon Board of Optometry is opposed to this legislation as it is written with the Dash 1 amendments. There are several parts of the law that would have a positive impact, while others would only serve to complicate business activities.
Excuse me, are you reporting a formal action of the board?
Pardon me?
Are you reporting a formal action of the board?
Yes.
The board has passed a motion in opposition to this. That's what.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There are several portions of this bill that have a positive impact, while others would serve to complicate the board's activities, thus decreasing its efficiency, making it more difficult for the board to perform its primary function of protecting the public. We appreciate the language that allows the board to have appropriate jurisprudence over licensees regardless of their current license status. The board currently does adhere to the privacy language in this bill. Section 47 increases public representation on the board without the loss of professional representation, and we would welcome the additional public input. Our problems with this bill begin in Section 4.2. The Oregon Board of Optometry does have an effective apolitical process in place to hire and compensate our executive director. Section 4.2 would introduce a new layer of requirements, state personnel law, to that process, decreasing efficiency while trying to fix a problem that does not exist. This subsection also states that the executive director would serve at the pleasure of the governor. This introduces the possibility for political influence in selecting the executive director. Under present statute, the board of directors who employ the executive director serve at the pleasure of the governor. If the governor does not approve of the board's executive director, he could approach the board to resolve the issue. Therefore, there is a mechanism in place for the governor to intervene should it be necessary. And I believe that this process in a board of our size would be effective and timely. Section 4.3 of the -1 amendments would allow any part of the executive department to impose any duty they desire on the Oregon Board of Optometry's executive director. It is very possible that duties could be applied to all health boards, but be inappropriate, again, for small boards like ours. Of course, there are an endless number of duties that could be imposed that would decrease the time our executive director has to address the needs of the board of directors who are serving Oregonians. Section 4.4 would require certain activities of the board to be reported to the governor. This, by itself, is not a bad concept, yet DAS would dictate the reporting process. This would create unnecessary red tape, further contributing to the duties of the executive director. Additionally, the information contained in the proposed report would include a peer review of our executive director by other health regulatory board executive directors, as we have already heard, as well as a public member. I believe that this is unnecessary and would increase the board's operating expenses. The Board of Optometry's executive director's performance is reviewed formally on an annual basis by its board of directors who are most familiar with his work, rather than by those who are not. It is also reviewed informally at every board meeting. There are positive components to this bill, but there is considerable language that attempts to solve problems that we feel do not exist while increasing the board's operating expenses and decreasing its efficiency and ability to serve the citizens of Oregon.
You record the proceedings of your board?
Yes.
Could you make available to us the recording of the proceedings where you acted on this bill? I'd be very interested in hearing that discussion.
I did an individual poll of board members.
You didn't have any discussion on the board?
I did individually, yes.
Did you record those?
They have all read.
But did you record the discussion, the deliberations of the board that got to this motion?
Okay. I guess if you're asking if we had a formal vote, if we had a meeting of the board.
And discussed this?
We had discussed it at a prior meeting, yes. But
could you provide the recording of the discussions that you had that led you to this conclusion?
I believe I can do that.
I'd appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
And you had an actual vote of the board to come to this conclusion?
Yes, I did poll the board members.
Is that how you act on the board, by you polling members? Is that how you do your business?
We typically have a board meeting where the majority of board members are present, which is generally all of us, and we act on items there. That was not possible for this particular bill for me to do that.
Are there other things you do this way in terms of your decisions of the board?
No.
This is an unusual action.
Yes, it is.
What required this drastic action?
Because I was aware that was an important issue today, that you wanted to be sure that I was not speaking by myself, but that I was speaking for the Oregon Board of Optometry.
If this bill passed, would your executive director's salary be under DAS guidelines?
It would be under the state personnel regulatory.
It would. Do you know what the executive salary of, what the board, what the salary of your executive director is?
No, I do not.
We can supply that. Would you be surprised if I told you it was significantly higher than exec secs of other boards?
No, I would not.
That wouldn't surprise you?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do have a question about the use of the word apolitical process.
Yes.
In hiring and compensating. I mean, it may be secondary, but it is a political process to get on the board because it's an appointment through the governor. And I'm not quite sure that we have an apolitical process, and it's designed that way on purpose. Not quite sure you can get away from it. And so I'm not sure that, you know, by changing that configuration that you're going to retain any sort of apoliticizing of this.
I guess my concern with that is that you could conceivably have a change of administration and they could decide that they wanted to clean house, change the executive directors of the various agencies, and that would be pretty disruptive to the operation of the board.
I guess the answer would be yes, and I believe that the governor probably should have that authority. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Are some of the boards included in this among the quasi-independent boards?
Semi-independent boards. Yes, they are.
Semi-independent, thank you.
All the health professional boards are included in this. This is a
partial
step. And I can't
remember, is optometry one of the semi-independents?
Yes, it is.
That's what I was thinking.
Well, we'll have evidence when we get to that about how efficient they are as a board in terms of how much more per licensee they cost than other boards, and we'll be looking at the relative salaries of the executive secs. But one of the interesting things is you'll see the exec secs of the semi-independent boards are significantly higher than the exec secs of similar boards who follow state regulations. But we'll have that discussion in a separate place. Have at it.
Thank you, Chair Greenlook and members of the committee. I am Dr. Scott Nearing, a practicing optometric physician in Woodburn and a member of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. Appreciate the opportunity to speak before your committee about House Bill 2118-1, specifically sections 4.2, 4.3, and 4.4. I have been licensed by the Oregon Board of Optometry for over 25 years, and during that time, the OBO has protected the citizens of Oregon effectively with the current structure that is in place. The semi-independent status of the OBO has allowed them to manage the resources available to be effective. At the same time, licensing fees have remained reasonable.
Excuse me, do you have any evidence of that?
Do I have evidence of?
Yes, that you've managed to be effective as a board.
Only from my personal experience of reading the newsletters and monitoring my profession would I have that experience, sir.
Thank you.
Could I address that?
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the ways that we can show our effectiveness is how quickly we respond to complaints. When we receive a complaint, the board almost always deals with that complaint.
What's the range of time in dealing with a complaint for your board?
At the next board meeting, so within 90 days.
You have the data on that? It would be good to see that.
Yeah, I believe we can come up with
that. The report you have is a couple, 3 years old, but it would be good to see that from recent.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, go ahead.
At the same time, the licensing fee has remained reasonable and controlled for my colleagues across the state. I believe the OBO has carried out their mission of overseeing the profession and done so in a fiscally responsible manner, therefore benefiting the citizens of Oregon and the doctors of optometry. My concerns are that sections 4.2, 4.3, and 4.4 would hamper the ability of the OBO to operate in the efficient, fiscally responsible manner that they operate under this time. The system that is currently utilized has the proper checks and balances in place. The current makeup of the board, including executive director, staff, and members of the board, is working. Putting more requirements on the executive director will make the process more cumbersome, time-consuming, and difficult. The mission of the Oregon Board of Optometry to protect the citizens of Oregon is working. The mission of a fiscally responsible board for optometric physicians is working. House Bill 2118 with the -1 amendments will only serve to detract from those missions. Thank you.
It would be very useful to us if you provided the data on the fiscal responsibility and on the checks and balance that you say are in place. Do you have examples of the checks and balance off the top of your head?
No, I don't. Again, I'm representing the Oregon Optometric Assistance Association and myself personally to let you know that what I have noticed over the 25 years, but I don't have specific data because much of that is done in executive session and the rulings are there. I would have to comb through all that, which I'm sure is there, but I don't personally have that on hand.
Just checking. You're testifying. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
If you'd like to provide more information, that'd be great. Holly Mercer. Kathleen Haley. Back again. And who do we have next? Lori Mekkonen. Let me say where we're going to be. I'd like to move this testimony as fast as we can. We have some people that have come to testify for House Bill 2345. I intend not to have a full discussion of that, but some folks have come from out of town to testify on that. I want to make sure we have a chance to get their testimony. We'll be back on that bill at a later time because we're in the midst of working. So we have a couple more witnesses after this panel on 2118, and then we'll open up a hearing on 2345. I'd like to get that all done by about 4:15, so we have time for the presentation from the Hospital Association. Thank you all very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Holly Mercer. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Nursing. The Oregon State Board of Nursing wishes to submit testimony regarding House Bill 2118. The board supports House Bill 2118, but would like to comment specifically on two aspects of the bill. Section 1, Sub 3 of the bill gives health regulatory boards the authority to require fingerprint background checks of licensees, employees, volunteers, or applicants for licensure or employment. We strongly support this section of the bill. Board of Nursing employees investigate the backgrounds of licensees through the State Law Enforcement Data System, or LEDS, and fingerprint-based national criminal background checks as a function of their job. Since the Federal Bureau of Investigation requires all employees who view LEDS reports information to undergo fingerprint background checks, it is imperative that the board have the authority to require background checks of its licensing and investigation employees. Further, the public should be ensured that the board holds its employees to the same high standards as it holds licensees. I'd also like to comment on Section 4, Sub 2 of House Bill 2118. It requires the executive directors of health regulatory boards to serve at the pleasure of the governor. The Board of Nursing did express some concern regarding this language, considering the possibility that a future governor might be tempted to perform a clean sweep of all agency executive directors entering office. However, the board also recognizes this is not necessarily a practical fear, considering that continuity among basic service levels is desirable during times of administrative transition. Moreover, given the Board of Nursing's recent history, we are painfully aware of how board members may rely upon and trust the information provided by an executive director who may not be providing them with all the relevant information concerning a situation. It is understandable that in this type of rare situation, the governor's office would need the ability to respond quickly to substantiated concerns to ensure the public safety. And, Chair, with your permission, I would just like to make a personal note on this section of the bill.
You certainly have my permission.
I would like the committee to know that without the assistance of the governor's office over this past year, the Board of Nursing could not have made the significant and necessary changes to move this agency forward. I understand why there is concern about losing the authority over the position of the executive director. I also realize that I am new to this political process and may not always appreciate the nuances of concerning political decisions. But having reviewed and audited several of the files that were at issue in those media accounts in the summer of 2007, I can convey to this committee that the board did not have all the relevant facts, and given the urgency and severity of the issues concerning public safety, the governor clearly needed unencumbered authority to take decisive action. I am hopeful that this committee will support this bill, and I'm open to questions.
All right, thank you for your statement. Howie, let me ask both you and Kathleen. You're both scheduled to testify on 2345. Can you hold that, or do you want to comment on it? You both hold it. We'll be dealing with that in a much.
Sure. Okay. Thank you. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Board. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on this bill. The board is in support of the bill. We, too, would like to thank the Governor's Office for working with the health regulatory boards in the last year to bring about continuity where appropriate for the health care professional boards. The two areas that I would like to speak to in the bill today are, first, the mandatory reporting section found in Section 1, Sub 4. Most of the healthcare regulatory boards do have mandatory reporting of incompetence, unprofessional or dishonorable conduct, or impairment in their statute. However, they're not consistent. Some also have it in rule, and still others of the health regulatory boards don't have it available to them at all. This bill would codify that and make it uniform in terms of what is expected of licensees of the boards. The board also supports this because it ties back to our mission of public safety. It would define what must be reported and by whom, and that would guarantee that their investigations are conducted on all applicable violations of the Practice Act. The second area that I'd like to testify about is the public member portion, and for the medical board, that's found in Section 24, Sub 1. This definition is very helpful because it provides clear guidelines on who can serve. And the board also supports its members serving at the pleasure of the governor as written in Section 24, Sub 4. The board respectfully requests, and we've discussed this with the governor's office, that the committee consider an amendment to Section 24, Sub 2. And as it's written, and I think this may have been a drafting error, the bill would have the professional associations suggesting public members to the board, and I think the intention was to limit it to the professional members.
We're getting a nod that that is a drafting error.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to comment, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Just reminded me before we get questions, that I want to tell the committee, there is the ability for committee members to observe your board meetings, including disciplinary actions. Is that right?
Chair Greenlick, that's correct, and we would welcome your participation.
I think that's something you might find very interesting. I've visited and found it very enlightening. And it's a matter of scheduling, but they happen early in the morning, usually. And it is something that each of you might want to take an opportunity to sit on that and see how that goes. Is that true, the nursing as well?
True.
Are you going to use your Learjet to fly us up from somewhere?
No, but I think we should try and all fly in the same Learjet rather than...
Okay.
Thank you. Any questions, Ms. Haley? You had a full board discussion on these issues?
Chair Greenlick, we have a legislative committee that reviews them, and then we give regular reports to the board.
Ms. Mercer, did you...
We actually had Claudia Black present this to the board last summer during a work session, and she received generalized feedback from the board.
Yeah. I also want to make a personal comment. I think Ms. Black has done an extraordinary job.
Yes.
This has not been an easy process over the last year or so, and she's done an unbelievable job trying to keep you all involved in that. I think that's...
Thank
you. Okay. Yes. Mackinnon, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members. I'm Laurie Mackinnon, Director of the Veterinary Board, and I'm here to present the board's support of HB 2118. Specifically, the portion dealing with protection of licensee private emails. It's my fault that this provision is in the bill because last year I denied a public records request for licensee emails, and it was challenged to the Attorney General. And the opinion that came back was that, indeed, we do have to disclose licensee email addresses, even though we had been advised by our AG, and we understood that other boards were also shielding those. Other boards were also declining to disclose licensee private email addresses. And what we were told with the challenge was that if we pursued a formal opinion, that opinion would likely also designate officially that home addresses and home phone numbers were also disclosable to the public. So I felt I was between a rock and a hard place, and I disclosed the email addresses rather than have an official opinion that might have made it more inclusive for disclosure. And the licensees were pretty unhappy about this, and we've subsequently lost probably half or more of the email addresses that we have in our database. And this came at a very bad time because we were just rolling out our online renewal process. And instead of being able to send renewals via email, we had to send paper forms instructing licensees where to go to renew online, and we thought that was counter to the whole purpose of streamlining and doing online renewals.
Does this draft of the bill protect home addresses?
It protects home email addresses, but not home addresses or home phone numbers, just email addresses.
I think we had a suggestion somewhere here that we ought to be adding home addresses. Business addresses would be available.
Right? Business addresses would be available. Business email addresses would be available. And for us, because we were not... We only had one field in our database for an email address. What we will be able to do if this bill passes is designate one email as a business address and the other one is confidential. And there's another important reason why we need to be able to shield email addresses, and that is that the state's public health veterinarian, Dr. Emilio DeBess, regularly sends out public health alerts to veterinarians. He's recently been sending alerts about monkeypox and the melanin pet poisoning and now the peanut butter contamination. And he relies on our database because DHS doesn't maintain a database of veterinarians.
Would there be any objection to adding home addresses to this protection and home phone numbers and home addresses? That would be for all the boards, right? Would you see that it gets into the dash two? And it's your fault. We know who to blame now.
I'm happy to take the blame.
Can I just ask a question, just to help me understand the problem? What in the case that provoked this? What was the the purpose of the records request?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Demereau, the individual requesting the information he wanted, business address, business phone number, and all emails. Was a representative of an insurance agency, and he just wanted to solicit business. And when I let licensees know that I had to release their email addresses, and I let them know who was going to be contacting them, and my understanding is that quite a few of them contacted that individual and said, don't ever bother me again. So, you know, it didn't really work out to his benefit, even though he got the email addresses.
Thank you. Might be handy to be able to get my doctor's home email. You're not going to stop me from getting that, are you? I'm sorry, Representative Kennedy.
I just wondered. We don't have any feedback about whether all boards would want these automatically excluded, or maybe we should make it optional.
I think we excluded it from a required. Response, they could make it available. Is that correct, Anna? I mean, if we said you do not have to give this in response to a public inquiry, would that mean you would not be able to give it if you so desire? We have somebody from DOJ sitting over here. Maybe
it's like a double negative.
I just love this process.
If it's exempting from disclosure.
You see the head nods. And
no, yeah.
Depends on what we're doing.
We have an attorney. Here we go.
If we're creating an exemption to the public records law, then the boards would not have, I believe, the discretion to release that information. And so Representative Kenemer is suggesting a different approach that would make it voluntary, I think.
Well, I just don't know that we want to put them all off public record if there's no need to. On the other hand, it's nice to have that provision. And I mean, you know, it's interesting. I practice as a psychologist, and I always had that my home phone number listed and my address in the telephone book. And I didn't see the need for confidentiality, but some of my peers did. And I don't know what, you know, I just think we ought to have a little bit of process about how that amendment's drafted, I guess.
Well, let's say, why don't we get it drafted, and then let's bring it up here for discussion, and we can
and
we
get
can
some
see
feedback
like.
From the boards, I guess, is,
yeah.
if they have a preference.
Okay.
Thank you
all very
thank
much.
You.
I am watching the time, and it's driving me crazy. I'm going to invite three folks up here who are signed on both for this and for 2345 and find out whether they want to testify both of them at the same time. That would be Mike Crew, Lori Queen, and Patrick Bretz.
Open up a public hearing.
Okay, yeah, let me do that. I'll open up a public hearing on 2345 in case we do want to get some testimony on that right now.
Representative Greenlick, my name is Mike Crew. I'm general counsel for the Oregon Medical Association. I'd rather reserve
Welcome.
My testimony for the 2345 when that bill comes up
for
later.
A different day. Okay.
And we have talked with Ms. Black and Ms. Hollister, and they've agreed to work with us on some language for Section 1 of 2118.
Oh, good. So you're happy with that. Good.
Okay.
Let's have more of that kind of testimony.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Lori Queen. I'm a psychologist. I'm currently serving as the president of the Oregon Psychological Association. I'd like to testify on 2118, and then I'll also address briefly, if you'd like, my views on 2345.
Save you a trip back, that'd be great.
Or both. Regarding, we're standing in favor of 2118. There are some concerns that we wanted to bring up, however, primarily the one in Section 1, Sub 5, regarding the statement saying that the person is not required to report a licensee patient receiving those services unless the licensee patient has an impairment due to a mental disability. Our primary concern here is indeed around the therapeutic aspect of confidentiality. So what we're looking for here is that somebody seeking services for therapy have the ability for confidentiality, which would not require disclosure or reporting. It's a concern that mental disability could certainly be read as mental illness or anything that essentially would prompt or require for reporting when somebody is coming seeking treatment for those services. So want to make sure that people feel ready and available to seek treatment without the fear of reporting in a protected confidential situation. Somewhat related to that, however, is the concern for the need to report for all professionals. It is not clear which behaviors of the, as stated, the unprofessional dishonorable conduct. It's not clear what I might define as unprofessional or dishonorable conduct in another profession, another health profession. So it would be nice to have some clarifying language of what kinds of behaviors would be required to be reported. Psychologists currently are required to report. We've also got, by law, a process through the American Psychological Association Code of Conduct and Ethics where we have the ability to resolve informal violations that would not be of public safety concerns, and then those would be up to a reporting. So it's a matter of whether or not a confidential report is left in a copy machine as opposed to whether or not somebody is showing up for a session incapacitated from substances. So those are some concerns that we have around the mandatory reporting aspect. Again, primarily the issue for that is indeed the confidentiality of the therapeutic relationship. Somewhat in relation to that are my concerns on 2345. Representative Chair Greenlick, would you like for me to address those at this time?
Or? Very briefly. We're going to work 2345. In fact, I'm going to name a working group
okay.
today to get that started looking at because there are a lot of issues on just how to deal with that, and it overlaps a bit with this, but it talks about how we structure those programs. And I might as well just announce what I was going to announce. I've asked Representative Maurer to head a work group that he can name himself. There are a lot of people who will volunteer how to deal with that, but it's an issue that's pretty significant, and we want to try and keep it straight. So okay. We are going to work. You might as well wait if you want till we get something back from that work group, so you see if it meets your needs.
Okay, certainly.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Patrick Bratz, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Board of Dentistry. I'm sorry I didn't get the red memo today to wear red attire.
Red attire is in honor of the identification that heart disease right. is, in fact, the number one killer of women. And it's a part of women's health exercise, and people have been asked to wear red to show solidarity with the relationship between heart disease and women's health.
And I think that's great. I had the red tie this morning and decided to change to.
Got the wristband. We're going to give you a pass.
Okay.
If some of us are more solid than others, you'll notice that Representative Maurer is really into solidarity.
The OBD believes that there are...
Right. My wife dresses me, so I wear what she tells me.
The OBD believes that there are many very good aspects to House Bill 2118 that have been introduced at the request of the governor, and one of these provisions is found, and I know you now have the Dash 1 amendment, but it's Section 2 of the Dash 1 amendments found on page 2 on line 14. This provision would require the executive directors of various healthcare-related licensing boards to prepare and submit periodic reports to their boards and the governor on the licensing, monitoring, and investigative activities of the board. These reports would be prepared based on rules developed by the Department of Administrative Services in consultation with the boards. These reports in the board will undergo a periodic review of the performance of the board. The review will be done by a peer review panel made up of other health executive directors and at least one public member from another healthcare-related licensing board. This concept is done in many of our industries today, such as at Boeing, and it's been found out to be very successful. About a year ago, I asked all of the healthcare-related licensing board executives if they'd like to meet on a periodic basis to discuss issues of mutual interest and concern, specifically so that we could work together on many of the issues that we face on a daily basis, and if others were having problems or had developed a best practice, that this information could be shared and we could all learn and help each other. I think the process, which has been going on for a little over a year, has been a good one, and that all of the executive directors have found this to be a very useful and helpful endeavor, and this proposal is somewhat of an offshoot of that group meeting. The executive directors as a group want each and every one of the health-related licensing boards to be able to accomplish their primary mission, which is protection of the public. And to not offer help and assistance to our fellow executive directors does not benefit our great state. I hope the committee will look favorably at this section on HB 2118, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. In regards to the question on the addresses and such information, we'd definitely be in favor of that. We collect this information, and we'll always continue to collect it, but it's the question of having to release it when we're requested to do so, which becomes a problem. And I'll pass in the 2345 until you have...
We'll hear from you, yes. Any questions? Thank you very much. I have John Betts and Stephen Gonfori left on 2118.
I was given the...
Okay, great. I have to listen to Kafori because he's my constituent. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Kafori, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I got you where I want you now.
It's a long time to get the vote again, remember.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here representing the Semi-Independent Boards Association. We came before you not too long ago talking about the issue of semi-independent boards and opposing the elimination of that status. That issue comes up again in this bill. There are many things in this bill which you've heard today are necessary and timely, and we're very supportive of that. Overall, we think 2118 is a good bill, and we also salute Claudia for her work on it. It's been not an easy task to get this put together. We have a couple of what I consider relatively small issues with the bill I'd like to discuss. And I guess the key here I want to remind the committee is we may always be sure that we're lining up the problems and the solutions. And remind you that the semi-independent boards have not been the source of many problems, and that the difficulties that have occurred have been with agencies that have been independent. I mean dependent, not independent. First, on page 2, line 32, it talks about the one phrase, notwithstanding ORS 182.468. This little phrase takes out the semi-independent status regarding what it, part of what it means to be a semi-independent board. And that has to do with the state personnel relations regarding selection, classification, and compensation of their executive directors. Right now...
Do you have written testimony, do you?
Excuse me?
Do you have written testimony?
I do not.
Okay. I'm sorry. It might help if you want to talk about something specific. If we'll be happy to take a memo when you're done.
Okay.
Go ahead and testify.
Yeah, thank you. My experience is when I provide something to read, they read and don't listen.
Wouldn't hurt to follow up with them.
I will definitely follow up with specific amendments that we'd like to have, Mr. Chair. Thank you. The law presently allows semi-independent boards to adopt their own personnel policies. Those policies are then run by DAS to ensure that they comply with the law. And then once they've run them by DAS and make sure that the policies comply with law, then we apply those policies without the need for further review. This section where it says notwithstanding ORS 182.468 would eliminate that ability. And one of the things you might notice here is that this applies only to the executive directors. So we'd, to some extent, be in an unusual situation of having two personnel policies, one for the executive director and one for the rest of the staff. The next concern we have has to do with the governor being allowed to hire and fire the executive directors. We want to repeat our concern that this could lead to...
Hire and fire.
Excuse me?
Not hire and fire. It's fire.
Fires, and not hired directly, but it's
with approval.
With approval. So it's the not hiring is an interesting issue, and if it's clear that this is not the governor hiring these people, that makes us feel a little better. There have been some instances in other states, Mr. Chair, where there when you have the issue of patronage, you get people hiring. These are not insignificant salaries. And there are a lot of people out of work, and if the friends of the governors get jobs, that's not the best way to hire people for regulatory boards. The other concern we have in this issue has to do with the relationship between a board and the executive director. I personally have served as chairman of boards of nonprofits. I've also been chairman of the board of the Portland School District and the State School Board Association. And I'm very much aware of the relationship between a board and its executive director when it's hired and when it's not. One of the two nonprofits that I am the chairman of the board of presently does not hire the executive director. And when you don't have that hiring and firing and direct responsibility line, it makes it difficult to establish authority and to make sure that it's clear who's in charge. I think when the board hires and fires the director, that's fine. That then people know where the line of authority lies. We're not unhappy with having the governor be able to take board members, hire them and fire them at will, with or without cause. That makes sense to us. Those are policy-making positions, and we think that's part of the governor's role. But to hire and fire a person whose job it is to administer something, especially in these small agencies, we don't think is correct. Finally, the third thing, Section 4 of Section 4 on page 2 has to do with quarterly reports to DHS. We're happy to make quarterly reports to DHS. We make lots of reports now to our boards and to the legislature and to the governor's office. Our only concern is that we'd like to be able to do that in the same format so that we don't have to have one format for one report and another format for another report. And this says in the bill that DHS will set up what that format is. We think that can be worked out, that if DHS works with the agencies to have a standardized format, that they've done some other work with the agencies, that that'll work. We are worried about the cost of the potential audits, and would like to ensure that when this auditing function happens, if this part of the bill passes, that those are not extreme. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you, and I will provide amendments to the committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Before you close, just for the record, Mr. Chair,
written stuff.
We have written testimony submitted by the McKenzie Animal Hospital on House Bill 2118, encouraging it to pass the bill, the Cemetery Association of Oregon in support of 2118, and the Woodburn Veterinarian Clinic, which was Jonathan Betts. All are recognized for the record.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Closed public hearing on 2118. I have three people scheduled to testify on 2345, Joe Bryson, Dr. Wyden, and Martin Piccioni. Would it be a problem if you want to testify? Let's do it now. Let's move along. If we can wait until we have something more substantive, that would be fine too. Your pleasure. Dr. Wyden, come here.
We would love to be able to have the opportunity to serve on a work group.
To
serve on a work group.
Okay. Representative Maurer will take nominees.
Yes.
Nominees?
Nominees for the work group.
Are we going to go through a selection process?
No.
Well,
yeah.
We're going to have a governor. It'll have to be approved by the governor.
This is informal.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, certainly the OMA ought to be involved in that, and there'll be some other specific ones. You're going to help staff that one, Tom?
And me.
Tom and Madam Administrator will help.
Madam Boss.
Madam Boss will help staff that. I'll close the public. Oh, wait a minute. Before I do that, there are a couple of DOJ folks with us today that I've asked to come in to talk about some issues about the federal confidentiality rules. Could you take a couple of moments and fill us in on that one? You've sat here for an hour and a half. I save you coming back. Who's paying for this, incidentally? That's not going to be charged to the committee, is it?
Representative, Mr. Chair, no.
Good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Warren Foote with the Department of Justice.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Grimms. I'm the attorney in charge of the Human Services and Education section of the General Counsel Division of the Department of Justice.
We've asked these folks with us because one of the things we're trying to achieve is the development of a monitoring program in terms of any health impaired professional programs of the boards. We're trying to create a monitoring program that when it finds information of illegal activity, it can provide that information to the board. There are federal statutes that make that difficult under certain circumstances, and I've asked them to come and briefly explain it to us if you would.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The particular federal laws that we're concerned about have to do with the confidentiality of patient records of people who are involved in a program that's covered by the regulations. The programs at issue are federally assisted substance abuse or drug and alcohol or drug abuse treatment programs. The parameters, though, are interesting here because, of course, the goal of the regulations is to protect the records of the patients. And so the federal government construes this very broadly. They want to protect as many records as possible. Also, there are federal criminal penalties for violators that are prosecuted by the United States Attorney's Office. And so the people who are involved in these activities are necessarily quite cautious because they don't want to run afoul of these federal requirements. So that creates an overall dynamic for the people who might find themselves within the definition of a program. One of the things that might seem to be a fairly slam dunk on this is that you have to be a federally assisted program. And you might think, well, this is totally state funded. Why are we even talking about these regulations? Again, the regulations are very broadly drafted, and their definition of federal assistance can even go to nonprofit entities that by virtue of their Internal Revenue Code benefit of being able to be a nonprofit organization qualifies as federally assisted. If they're designated as a provider for Medicare purposes, if they work for the Veterans Administration, there are a host of ways that programs that don't normally think of themselves as federally assisted can fall into that particular category. So we can't just assume that just because these entities that are being considered on their face aren't receiving a dime of federal money, to the best of my knowledge, there's still the possibility that within the scope of the federal regulations and how they're interpreted, they may be federally assisted. Let's say for the sake of argument, they do get some dime from the federal government that would qualify. Then the issue becomes whether they're providing diagnosis or treatment or referral to treatment. And again, those are defined terms in the federal regulations, but they're very broadly defined.
May I interrupt? Is this subservient or part of HIPAA? Or is this a separate statute?
Chairman and Representative Maurer, HIPAA is very different.
Okay.
HIPAA may apply to some of the people who do treatment.
Because HIPAA is not going to apply to the board.
Right. And there's...
But it isn't the board that's at issue here. It's the monitoring program that's at issue. What we're trying to do is to craft a monitoring program that does not do diagnosis, does not do referral, does not do treatment, and is not eligible for federal funds. If we can figure out how to do that, then that program, if they find information in the course of their activities, can report it to the board. But if they meet any of those other criteria, as I understand it, then they find somebody with a dirty urine and they can't report that to anybody if it's in what might be construed in a broadest way as a part of therapy. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, that's true. It's, if you can find a way to thread the needle very carefully, then it would not be within the subject matter of the federal regulations.
But, for example, it's very clear that the board couldn't refer somebody under this regulation to a monitoring program. The monitoring program said, all right, we're going to refer you to this treatment program because that's a preferred treatment program. Doing that would take away this exemption. If you did that, then they could not be reporting any information they found. Are we reading that correctly?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct, and that's the sort of broad nature of the definition of diagnosis,
so,
treatment, and referral.
Mr. Chair, are we going to have an opportunity to have counsel sit with us as we attempt to thread the needle?
You have to ask them. I think we have counsel, and I think we have adequate counsel. I think it would be useful for our counsel to be communicating, because it is our attempt to try and thread that needle. That's where we're trying to go. So we will have...
Well, we could just stop doing medicine in Oregon, and then we would solve the problem. Wouldn't have any boards to license. I mean, we will attempt to thread the needle. It's just, it almost seems like, how does the system work today? It's dysfunctional, but it works at some level. And we're trying to improve it.
That's what we're trying to do.
I hope there's a big darn hole in this big needle.
Or it's just good eyes.
Okay.
Any other cautions? It is our intention, at least, to draft a bill that will thread that needle. And we'll stay consulting with you. We have to have an agency that we forbid from being eligible for federal money, but I thought I heard you say if it's a 501c3, because it has federal tax exemption, it will automatically fall under this category?
Representative Chuck Greenlake, that's correct.
So we'd have to make sure
it's
not a 501c3.
For profit.
Well, or maybe a 501c4, right, which is not tax exempt. It's non-profit but not tax exempt. Or a for-profit. Or an individual proprietorship or something. We'll figure it out. Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate that.
Wow.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on 2, 3, 4, 5, an open and informational hearing on hospital finances and provider taxes. And we have Mr. Holt and some other guy who's coming to you, right? This is a presentation that was made last week, I think, roughly, to the Senate Committee on Health Policy. And I thought it would be useful. It relates to what Dr. McConnell presented to us pretty quickly. Okay. I thought it would be useful to have this at our as our background and be able to ask some questions about it. Thank you both for
thank you. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and with me is Kevin Earls, Vice President for Policy and Advocacy of the Association. Our goal today is to give you some context for the discussion that's going on in relation to House Bill 2009 and the provider tax. We're going to give you a little overview of where the money flows with hospitals through the payer system, and give you a very up-to-date snapshot with data that we got through the association as recently as this week through the end of December on the condition of hospitals today. So with that, we'll get into it. And feel free to at any time to stop us for questions. We'd hope to have some dialogue around this. A little bit about who the hospitals are. There's 57 acute care hospitals in the state. 25 of them are the large, what are referred to as DRG hospitals. That's lots of acronyms in healthcare. That's diagnostic related group. It's just the way that they bill. And then there are a dozen rural type A's that are less than 50 beds, and they're more than 30 miles from another facility, and 20 of the type B's that are less than 50 beds but are less than 30 miles from another facility. A few stats from 2000.
Are all those DRGs nonprofits?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't believe so. I think there's one for-profit.
Two
for-profit hospitals amongst
the
DRGs. there were about 7,500 licensed beds as of the end of 2007. And for the year, 350,000 acute discharges, 1.5 million patient days, about 8.4 million outpatient visits, and another not quite 500,000 home health visits. And you think of that in terms of Oregon population on average, that would mean that every one of us had a couple of encounters with the hospital. Of course, that's not true, but it's just the way the numbers work out. It's interesting how often Oregonians encounter our members. In terms of economic impact, the total employment is in flux with the rest of the economy right now, but these figures as of 2007 are around 56,000 employees. They tend to be very good jobs because there are so many health professionals involved, fairly high wages, a pretty good sized total payroll, and total economic impact of not quite $8 billion. And that includes all the purchasing, salaries, everything
else. Good
question.
Total employees, is that also like service employees or vendors or those kinds of, or is it direct employment?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kinnamer, my understanding is that's direct employees, but it would be everybody from the janitor on up to the CEO.
Sure, but you also interact with a host of others. Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
I think that's
Thank
the last line that they're making.
Hopefully that's what that is.
And on that employment, that most hospitals don't employ physicians.
Well, they don't employ many.
They sometimes employ some.
Is that an accurate statement?
Most hospitals don't employ physicians?
Yes, or have...
Most physicians working in the hospital are not included in your numbers, though.
Kevin, you might have a better view on that than I do.
The reason I'm asking a question, if you look at the average income, it might skew it if you included physicians.
And Mr. Chair, Vice Chair
Maurer. You're correct. Most physicians that are in our healthcare system are not employed by hospitals. However, it is a trend. There is a fairly significant trend towards hospitals employing physicians in Oregon as in other states. So there is a, the trend is more towards hospitalists or employed physicians.
To go back to that, it used to be physicians were in a lot of cases employed by hospitals. Then the trend was to go away from employment, and now you're saying it's going back. In a lot of cases, you have hospitalists who are actually contracted. Are those considered employees, those contract employees?
Sometimes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, for the purposes of our employment statistics, we're counting only people that are directly employed, not contractors.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay. This next slide is, I think, a slide that I think we're all looking to change with House Bill 2009 in some form, but this is where people get their health care coverage. The small groups and individuals are the yellow slices there of either the individual or 2 to 50 groups, and to the right are the domestic larger groups, so those are Oregon employers, Oregon insurers, and at the bottom you have Medicare at about 15%, and to the left, also in green, about 16%. Those are the self-insured ERISA plans. Those are both, of course, regulated federally rather than at a state level. And in between those two, you see the Medicaid population, and in red, the uninsured. And I chose those colors kind of on purpose. The yellows are, I think we all acknowledge, kind of a fragile, the most fragile part of the market. When premiums go up, they're the most likely to drop insurance. And you know, Medicaid is a fragile population in some respects. And so we just wanted to highlight that. In terms of sources of payment, and these are numbers right through the end of December, what we show here is that basically Medicare and Medicaid together account for about half of the sources of payment to hospitals. And then to,
excuse me?
Yes.
Are these actual dollars that flow, or are these the mythical charge numbers that relate to them?
Mr. Chairman, these are the actual dollars as far as I am
money
aware.
Money that flows through the real revenue money.
Yeah, these are actual revenue numbers. Those are shaded in red because those two payers pay below cost. And to the left, you see the commercial is kind of in gold, and that's the golden goose that makes that possible. We shift cost to them.
Getting sick right now. Haven't died quite yet.
And then the people feeling a little blue are paying on their own, and about 5% of the revenue is from those rare birds who are self-pay.
And wait a minute, can you go back there?
Sure.
Do you have an idea what the slice would look like of people who aren't paying at all?
Yes, actually, I
saw. We get to that?
It's not in this presentation, but the total non-pay would be about 5%, equivalent.
It's about $1.3 billion a year across the hospital.
Yeah, we do have a number. I think later on of uncompensated care in total. This is another kind of slice at the same data. Now these numbers are older, but the trends are still true. And what you see here is at the top line, well, kind of in the middle is 100. That's cost, 100% of cost. And so what you see at the top line is the commercial market paying well above cost in total. And then below that line, you see Medicare and Medicaid well below cost. And the average out end of 2004, that was at 106%. That number's lower now in total, and you'll see that in a minute. And this gets to your question just a moment ago. This, again, is fresh data. You'll see a couple of things there. One, in terms of numbers, and I apologize for the small type, but as of the full year 2008, uncompensated care, which was charity care and bad debt together, of not quite $1 billion. There's a pretty steep upward trend that begins when we cut way back on OHP standard a few years ago.
So when we get done and it'll be interesting to see your models, the extent to which we can reduce that $1 billion will have a significant effect on the hospital's net bottom line, right?
We would hope so.
I mean, if we can do something like that, reduce that by $250 million or something.
We'll be getting.
I assume your models will take that into consideration.
Yeah. That is taken into account in our modeling as it is in Dr. McConnell's model that you saw.
Good.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please just go ahead.
Tom, the uncompensated care, that's cost, right? That's not cost plus margin, or is it?
Chair Greenlink, Representative Bruin, thank you for the question. We track uncompensated care as billed charges, and I think we all acknowledge that billed charges aren't necessarily what ultimately gets paid. The important takeaway here is the trend.
That billed cost from the data that we gave you was about 60% of billed charges or something like that. I think something like that number.
Yeah.
But you're right, it's the trend. The trend will be exactly the same.
Didn't we
pass a bill recently that had you converting this to actual cost? So for future references.
Mr. Chair, yes, sir. It was a bill brought by the association last session to begin public reporting of uncompensated care on a cost basis.
But this is important because it didn't used to be. So this gives you the ability to see
exactly
what's happened.
Thank you.
Yes.
Question about the trend line. Tom, you said that when we dropped OHP, that the trend steepened. Is all of that increase or the incline a direct result of dropping numbers in OHP? It seems to me that the number of uninsured, or excuse me, the number on OHP decreased, but then it leveled off. It hasn't, the trend line hasn't done this.
Yeah. Chair Greenlink, Vice Chair Maurer, you're exactly right. I mean, there's more than one factor. That was sort of the kickoff point of a steepening of the trend. But obviously, as we have some increases in uninsured, that plays out into uncompensated care, or the benefit designs have changed rapidly in the last several years, so that many people have more responsibility for their share of payment, and they're not always able to meet those shares when they have a high cost case.
Mr. Chair, could I ask we suspend protocol here? When you have questions, just ask them directly, and when you give answers, just give them directly. This is be the easiest way for us to answer.
Thank you. Great, thank you. Could we go back a slide? Because I'd like to take another cut at this. If one of the things that I think is helpful to take away from this slide is look at 1999. If you look at the convergence of lines relatively at that point in our history, what you see is a fairly tight, relatively tighter cluster of Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial around the median of 100% or actual cost. So on the left axis, you have percent of costs. If you go to the 100% mark, that's what a hospital costs are for providing care, and it's agnostic as to who pays the bill. The cost is the same. But what the takeaway is here is that at that point in time, we had a good policy outcome in that the costs were relatively evenly distributed among the payer categories. Then what you see is, as you see the Medicare and Medicaid line begin trending downward as you move from 1999 forward, you see what happens to the green line that as it has to offset that, and you begin to get this spread of what payers pay relative to that 100% of cost. So I just think it's helpful to look at this because at that point in time, we were actually relatively successful in keeping costs relatively the same for different payers. But as Medicaid and Medicare begin to drift downward, then it becomes less affordable as those costs get picked up by the commercial market.
But, Kevin, I think the point – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. What you say is absolutely true. It's also true that the total drifts up by 6% in that time. So the rise in other costs more than offset between Medicare and Medicaid, correct?
Actually, Representative Harker, if we have another slide, and I don't know that it's in our presentation, but it shows that basically average hospital margins have been virtually flat for years in Oregon. We don't have, you know, the, I guess actually if you look at the black.
Not in dollars. They've been flat in terms of percentage of revenue.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And about 4%.
In terms of percentage.
You managed to make a 4% profit, however bad this thing looks, right?
Yeah.
Somehow you always manage to come out with that 4%.
And
Medicaid drops, Medicare drops, you jack up the price for somebody else, and you stay 4%.
Well, relatively, and of course, as the chair knows, that a 4% margin in our industry is necessary for getting an adequate bond rating that allows you to replace equipment and update and modernize as time goes on. So having a 4% margin is absolutely essential to organizations like Moody's and Standard & Poor's.
But I go hospital to hospital in this state and find them doubling their size, building new wings, doing all that stuff. They obviously did that some way. They got profits out of the system that allows them to create a new children's hospital that's not needed, double, create a new cancer unit, create another heart unit, all of which you end up finding a way to get paid for. Yeah. Right?
I mean, yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of a children's hospital that wasn't needed, but
I'll slip you a note that tells you which one it was.
I think that the point is that, as in any industry, ours needs a certain return in order to be able to sustain operation over time. And in our market, it's 4%.
Except this tells me a different story. The story this tells me is there's no such thing as free care, and there's no such thing as underpaid care, because ultimately, one payer doesn't pay, you charge it another one. GM hasn't found this curve. GM has found, as any other business, if they're making cars that the price goes up and they can't sell, and they don't, and I come in and say, I want to buy your car, but I only want to pay you $5,000 for it, and you say, it's all right, I'll take the five because I'll charge somebody else $100,000. I mean, what this shows is there's no such thing as free care.
That's right.
Whatever's going on, the hospitals have always managed to get their 4% margin to build another facility or to do whatever else needs doing.
And put another way, no matter how bad government underpays, hospitals can still successfully, in the short run, cost shift that to the commercial market.
In the short run, we have here from 1995 to 2004.
Yeah.
That's not a short run.
We will show you a little deeper into this, some
Let's
newer
go.
Data. We were just talking about cost shift, but in 2007, that shift amounted to $1.7 billion, pretty big number. And this is a really busy slide, but it's from the Healthcare Leadership Task Force study that just came out about a month ago, which was a group of healthcare purchasers that commissioned the study to get after, you know, what is the cost shift. And I think the takeaway here is in the percentage and in kind of the monthly amount. Many of you, as I do, have, you know, family coverage that we carry, and we pay a certain amount a month for that. And a typical, you know, employee under company coverage is paying now their portion, you know, not quite $500 a month. Well, not quite $200 of that is strictly due to cost shift. If there were no cost shift, they could be paying that much less. And that's an important factor in that that's one of the things that people will look at and, you know, maybe not make the choice that they would want to make or that we would hope people would make and drop coverage if that gets too expensive. So the more we can mitigate that cost shift, the better off we'll be and not have quite so much of the situation I think we all fear of spiraling into private insurance getting too expensive and needing more public, and it just feeds on itself. This gets a little bit to your question
with
pressure
chart?
Data.
I'm having trouble with this chart.
Okay.
Can you explain it to me?
It is a busy chart. The left side of it just looks at it and looks at the numbers in annual terms for the cost shift burden, and it gives you, you know, what the total average costs are, and this is looking at family coverage. So if you look at it like on a monthly basis on the right-hand side, the actual premium cost is around, you know, $1,800 to $1,900 a month. It's the true cost of that coverage when the employer is buying it.
$1,800 a month?
Yeah. And out of that, the employee share.
12 times that number should give you the $13,000?
If I can.
12 times 1,800 should be $13,000 or $14,000?
No, if I can take a run at it. If you look at the leftmost column labeled total annual cost, that's simply trying to show that if you look at where the total column and the total row align, $16,246 is the total cost of health care for a family of four in 2007 in Oregon. Mm-hmm. If you want to kind of unbundle that number, you can see under the premium column, about $10,000 of that's paid by the employer as premium, and about $3,600 is paid by the employee as premium. Then the employee has an additional $2,357, which they also contribute through cost sharing, so deductibles, copays, and so forth. So that shows that the employee portion of that $16,000, if you follow the row left to right, is about $6,000. The employer portion is about $10,243, and it totals to $16,246.
Okay.
Now if you look at the right series of columns that are labeled portion due to cost shift, it breaks out just what portion of that $16,246 is attributable to cost shift and how it's made up. The premium portion that employers pay is valued at $1,378. The employee contributes about $490 in cost shift, or experiences about $490 in cost shift. So about $1,869 in premium out of the $16,246 are attributable to cost shifting. The employee then picks up additional impact from cost shifting of $341, the total being from employer and employee of about $2,200 a year in cost shifting from both premium and cost sharing, employee and employer. And that is reflected as about a 13.6% impact.
If we could cut the cost shift in half, say, just roughly, then that would reduce the total premium by about 8%.
If you could cut the premium portion of the cost shift in half, it would reduce it by basically $935, or half of the premium column.
On $14,000. Right. I mean, let's make that $2,000 and $15,000. If we could cut the cost shift in half, that would reduce the $14,000 premium by about $1,000.
Yeah.
So it would be something like we could reduce the premiums if we just cut the cost shift in half, not eliminate it, but if we cut the cost shift in half, which comes from uncompensated care and undercompensated care, we could reduce health insurance premiums by 8%. Is that what you're testifying here?
If you could cut the premium in half,
the cost shift part of the premium.
If you could cut the cost shift in half, and were agnostic as to who was paying it, whether it was the employer or the employee,
right.
You could cut 13.6% down to 6.8%.
13.6%.
Yeah.
You could cut $14,000 a year premium down to $13,000 a year premium. Is that right?
Yeah. All other things being equal,
sure. Something like an 8% reduction in premium. So all you have to do to reduce the premium is reduce the cost shift, right?
Man.
That logic doesn't hold true, because who's paying for Medicaid and Medicare?
Well, that's in this.
No, who's paying for the additional reimbursement for Medicaid and Medicare?
Right there,
the employers and employees, when they're paying taxes.
The other thing,
doesn't go pink when it shows up. Someone's paying the tax bill.
This is, of course, only one element.
Yeah, if you think this would reduce our federal tax bill, that's a different question. But The principle is here.
It's all taxes.
The principle, this isn't about taxes. This is about the hospitals directly shifting costs to the insured population. And what we're saying, what I'm saying is, and I it seems obvious to me, if we can magically find a way to cut the cost shift in half, so you're not paying 130% of costs if you have insurance, you're only paying 115% of costs for a hospital bill when you have insurance, it would reduce the premium by about 9% based on 8-9% based on these data, let's say 8%.
And that, and I'm not disagreeing with that logic.
That's it.
But
that's the logic I'm trying to get to here.
That would last a year, but maybe a couple years. Until you reduce the cost.
Yeah. Well,
no, just
it
the
would
cost.
Be it would be a one time reduction if you did it one time. If you dropped it in half one time, it would lower the base upon which other things would be happening by 8% based on these numbers. These are the only numbers I have.
But Mr. Chair, wouldn't there be costs involved in?
Well, let's find out about that as a separate question.
I think Ron's right though, isn't it? Because if we're talking about percentages here, convert that into national dollars, and those dollars that you used to reduce that had to come from somewhere, and they're going to end up being public money.
I'm going to say right now they come from a magic place. I'm just trying to look at. I'm just trying, which I know that magic place is.
Does
it's Washington.
Take us to
but the point is, it's just I'm trying to look at levers here. So I mean, what I've heard from some people say magic is if we reduce this cost shift, it'll increase premiums. And my sense is if we reduce this cost shift, it will reduce premiums.
Who says that? I agree with your logic.
Okay, that's we'll get to some more discussion about it.
And just to add one more piece to the mix, if you think about the contributors to rising healthcare costs, of course, the cost shift is just one of those. And in looking at the
cost shift does not contribute at all to increased rising costs.
Oh. Well,
I
would respectfully disagree that consumers that pay healthcare costs through commercial premiums find that it very much does drive healthcare costs up for them.
It increases health insurance premiums. That's not the same as increasing costs.
A distinction that's probably lost on the consumer, but you're right.
Well, it shouldn't be. Go back to your earlier slide where you have that line that has costs going up 6%. That didn't have anything to do with the cost shift.
Cost.
Yeah, that's what. Look at that. Where's
the one
that
with the
one.
Four lines on it?
See that line that goes from 100 to 106%? That's the cost of health care. That doesn't relate to how you pay for it. That's the underlying cost of health care. That's raised from 100%. I don't see the date on it.
That's 2004.
It's through 2004, and that line actually comes back down a ways since then. And you'll see that in a minute.
But the point is, cost shifting didn't have anything to do with that cost. What that cost did was increase cost shifting.
Yeah. How much is that? Is philanthropy?
So what's philanthropy?
Of the 6%. I mean, I for 9 years I sat on a foundation board,
cost of
and philanthropy was counted into the margin. And it didn't go down every year.
This isn't a margin. This is the underlying cost of health care. This is the hospital cost of health care. That's you're presenting it. It's
no.
That's what this line is, right?
Yes.
You can see it directly increased the cost shift. But it that increase
100% is your cost.
I think the 100%
was the cost at this point in time.
Mr. Chair, I'm confused then. I thought the 106 indicated that they were being reimbursed at a total rate of 106% of cost.
Correct.
6%, in other words, is their profit.
That's right. No, absolutely.
Okay.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right. That's right. Well, all that bad things happened, their margin went up.
Right.
So, sorry, that's okay. Here's an update on margins, and since 2004, it's dropped rather substantially. It's now, I believe, the actual number is about 3.8 as of the end of 2008, and heading downward. Well, that's been a pretty steady trend.
Quick question?
Sure.
Details, I know. But I think that this slide shows the 04 margin at 5%, and the other was 6%.
Difference in, is a good question, Representative Harker. Difference between operating margin and total margin. So, that again, you'll have non-operating income, investment income, and other things.
Thank you. My mistake.
Yeah.
And so when all that tanks, your non-operating margin goes through the floor, which it has, then you, in fact, go the other way.
But the operating margin, if the non-operating margin, if it was in here until 2007, added to this, their stock market investments and the gift shop, and there are a variety of other things go into that, it would have had the total operating margins, I mean, the total margins would have been higher all along. About 2007, the non-operating part of the margins tanked, and that's what sunk. That's basically why this line is dropping.
This chart is showing only operating. It's not a total. And that's the, I mean, Representative Harker, you picked up an important difference in the data. There's
totals made it worse. No?
Yeah.
It was higher before, and now it's
yes,
lower.
And
Mr. Chair, I think in just to try and put a bow on this, when if you go back to the operating margin slide, I mean, this is what a hospital's core business is. This is, you know, this is the part about taking care of patients,
right.
And you'd like that to be a relatively stable margin. You have, as a hospital, some challenges in trying to have a stable margin when you can't control the payment rates that you get from half of your book of business, Medicaid and Medicare. Because you're a price taker, you get what you get. Your prices are set by the purchaser. So there's some challenge in kind of balancing a margin. But this is our core business. If you look at non-operating margin, investment income, and those kinds of things, as we all know from our personal experience, you can't necessarily control those things as well as we would like. We're painfully aware of that these days. So in good years, when investment income is bringing overall margin up, it helps offset losses to service lines and underpayment from government sources and so forth. When that investment income drops, as it has in the past year, for hospitals, just like it has in your 401ks, it isn't available, to help offset from a total margin perspective.
But the hospital margin, you talk about consistency, it's been consistently over 3% for the last decade. There aren't very many American corporations that could say their net profit has been consistently over 3% for 10 years in a row. That's pretty consistent.
And Mr. Chair, I think you mean that as a good thing.
I do.
Good.
No, absolutely I do. You were saying that it's been hard to achieve a consistent return, but the fact is this chart shows if you draw a 3% line across there, the hospitals have managed
The variance has been, within...
On the plus side, that's 3%.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at, if you look just at 99 to 02, you're going from 3% to 5.25%. That's a pretty big variance in a relatively short period of time.
Nobody objects to that, right? I mean, the hospitals don't... Gosh, we had this terrible variance. We made too much margin this year.
I mean, Mr. Chair, I'm sure you mean that in both directions. You know, the people are concerned about that.
I mean that very positively.
It's just a challenge.
I really do. I'm saying hospitals have been able to maintain, which is a good thing. We need hospitals. Nobody here doesn't want hospitals. You know, I love St. Vincent's. I go there, unfortunately, too frequently. But I'm glad they're there when they're there. No, I'm saying that this is a good picture. And if you take all that money under that curve, above 3%, that means not only has the hospitals been able to maintain more than 3% a year, whatever happens to them, consistently over the last decade, but there's maybe a 1.5% accumulation above 3%. That's not bad. I mean, that's good.
Well, but the business hasn't been static in that time. The business, the demographics changed, so you're business model changes. You build a new wing to increase the profit because you're losing more and more money in other books of business. So you say, we need to do something that's going to make money.
That's right. You say, rather than cutting costs, we'll maximize revenue. That has been the hospital's traditional response. Medicare pays 87% rather than doing what Toyota would do and say, how do we get our costs under 87%? How do we get more efficient? You say, well, we don't have to get more efficient. We'll just get more revenue.
Mr. Chair, I think that the statistics that you're familiar with about Oregon's position in the national context about having highly efficient hospital care is, you know, important to bring up. You know, Oregon is one of the most efficient states in terms of the cost of hospital care, shortness of length of stay, shortness of cost per stay of any state in the country. So in terms of managing hospital costs, Oregon is at the top of the class. It's one of the best states in the country. And numbers every year show that.
It relates almost entirely to the admissions rate, which is very good, reducing the admission rate. You're right. It's been very effective. The hospitals have done very well during that period.
But another piece of this is also an average over a large number of hospitals. And if you want to pull my hospital, Willamette Falls, for example, we have a hospital that's in serious jeopardy, I think, at least a serious struggle. So, you know, the variability, and I suspect some of the rural hospitals this is not very reflective of their particular instance.
And Representative Kemmer makes a really important point that when we look at these statewide averages, it does kind of obscure the individual hospital performance. What we're going to conclude with, or in a moment in our presentation, we're going to look at kind of the downward trend of a number of hospitals in terms of their overall margin as they're facing the same combination of factors that are occurring in the economy, a downward trend of investment income, lower patient admissions, reduction in philanthropy, increased demand from uncompensated care, and those are driving hospital margins downward in the current time frame.
Okay, let's go. Let's see.
Oops. You know, and I think we've talked a lot about this already, but if there's no margin, there is no mission. We build up reserves and use those to buffer the hard times, goes to endowments that help to back up charity care, of course, and then capital projects. Those savings become leverage for capital. It's a myth that healthcare is immune from the economy. There's been a dramatic drop in elective procedures. We don't have a stat on that. It's a little hard to parse out in the data sets that we get, but anecdotally, that's what we're hearing. There's been a pretty consistent increase year over year in ER visits.
No, I'm going to say, Three Rivers Hospital, they have been down in the number of elective procedures.
Yeah.
Sounds great. Reduces the cost of medical care.
I'm not going to totally disagree with that.
Yeah. And I think Kevin's going to get into some individual numbers here in a moment. I'll just get to that. And we have some examples of hospitals in some of your districts. And this is very fresh data. Go ahead, Kevin.
So what we wanted to do for the committee's benefit today was try and pull together a five-year running snapshot of operating and total margin by facility. These are hospitals. I think we pulled primarily DRG hospitals, so larger facilities. So first we have Legacy Good Samaritan Hospital in Chair Greenlick's district. This is a hospital that provides a tremendous amount of tertiary care to hospitals all around the state. It's you can see, you know, the total margins have been healthy at times. They reached an 8% peak in 2006. They're now in the negative numbers 2 years later.
But the operating margins, which you said is the real number?
The operating, no, I, stayed I, right I, at the I didn't say it was the real number.
I said, right, it's, you it's said the number. that's the true picture of the hospital's business?
It's okay. The number that represents the core business of the hospital.
St. Vincent that's patient stayed care. At about 8% or 9% all the time?
He's on legacy.
I know what he's on. I'm looking at the first one that had my name on it, St. Vincent. Stayed at 8 to 9% the whole...
I think the first one that has your name on it's the one on the screen.
Got two.
Not in my package.
There are two hospitals.
Double sided.
So you want to look at St. B's?
Yeah.
Oh, you're okay. We
want to look at St. Vincent.
Well, let's just take them in order. So.
Okay.
Legacy. I'm happy to look at
Good Sam. Legacy.
We've got.
There we go.
Legacy Good Sam. Here's Legacy Meridian Park. Now, you know, Meridian Park is a hospital only, you know, miles away from Good Sam and Legacy Emmanuel Hospital. But kind of worlds apart in terms of its patient mix. It's a suburban hospital, affluent neighborhood or catchment area, very little uncompensated care. So you can see, you know, they've had better operating margin results over time, but their total margin is down, as you would imagine, primarily from losses due to investment income.
Looks like my IRA, Kevin.
Yes.
And mine. And next one. Providence Portland Medical Center. Again, you know, fairly stable top line total margin, but patient margins trending downward over time. We're down, you know, in a patient, just above a break even on patient service margin, operating margin for 2008. Here's St. Vincent's, very large specialty, many of the highest quality specialty services in the state, great cardiac unit, known throughout the state for the quality of its care. Also seeing a relatively steady operating margin over time, reflects, you know, good management, a fairly attractive payer mix. Again, it's in a relatively suburban area, and provides a fair amount of higher margin services, but the total margin that incorporates operating margin as well as non-operating margin is trending downward. It's below the 0% line for 2008.
Kevin, I mean, let's talk about this one. This hospital was 10% in 2004, 10% in 2005, 12% in 2006, 18% in 2007. And you're telling me because the stock market tanked, I should be feeling sorry for this hospital?
I'm not asking you to feel sorry for the hospital.
I've been there three times in the last 3 years. So.
I'm sure that's not why it's gone down.
I've put a lot of money into this hospital. I've paid all the time. Paid well.
You know, an important thing to look at, though, with Providence or the legacy two site slides that are here, that across the system, the higher margin hospital is subsidizing the lower margin hospital. So up above that level, there
you got a few other Providence hospitals in here. Though.
We do, Mr. Chair. I mean, one thing I would point out is that the percentage increments on the left are different in these slides. So that. The lines are not necessarily consistent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is Three Rivers Community Hospital, Representative Maurer's district. I think you were mentioning some of the challenges they've been facing. I don't know. We're missing the operating margin on that slide. But you know, shows total margin declining again over a two-year period. Willamette Falls, Representative Kennemer's district. Been struggling, as has been covered in the local media recently. Kind of on the upswing for operating margin, but the total margin again is in negative territory for 2008.
We just discovered why Mao why Three Rivers has dropped.
Yeah.
When Mowers came here and stopped working with them, their margins dropped dramatically.
So we wanted to turn now to some discussion about Oregon's provider tax.
We've got a little bit more time.
And some of
we'll
you...
We'll take 10 more minutes. Huh?
Okay. Some of you were here at the creation of the provider tax, and some were not. It was something initiated by the association a few years ago, and the intention was to mitigate the cost shift that we were talking about a little bit ago. And there's criteria that apply to any of these provider tax regimes, and that they have to be uniform, that is the same rate on the same class of taxed entities, broad-based, and redistributive, meaning they have to be, there have to be winners and losers in the tax. In the aggregate, the current tax gets returned to hospitals in the form of higher fee-for-service reimbursements. That's a distinction that's important because the majority of the Medicaid in Oregon is, of course, managed care. So we're squeezing that enhanced reimbursement through a smaller piece of the pie. It became, though, the last time we were having intense meetings about budgets, the rescue plan for OHP Standard, and now funds about 25,000 lives in OHP Standard from all the taxed entities. The Medicaid managed care plans are also taxed. About a third of the revenue comes from hospitals, and the other two-thirds comes from the managed care tax. And the current rate of hospitals, it says there, is 0.63, which yields a little better than $40 million a year for the tax. That, of course, is used to get federal matching monies that come back to Oregon. And that first increment gets used to make hospitals whole. And then we fund, you know, if you think about it in thirds, roughly 8,000 or so lives in OHP Standard are funded by the hospital tax. There are some issues with the provider tax going forward. CMS for years has been stating its intent to squeeze these regimes out, going back to the Clinton administration, and you know, we don't know what the Obama administration is yet going to say. But the rules have changed at a first stage where, and I think you're all familiar with this, that the current tax applies only on the insurer side, applies only to Medicaid managed care organizations. Effective October 1st, it has to apply to all managed cares if there is going to be a tax on managed care. So one way or another, we have to enact a new form of a provider tax. And you've all heard in great detail about the governor's proposed budget that includes the 4% tax that would raise about $700 million from hospitals alone.
We have to or not?
Pardon me?
We have to enact a new form of hospital tax or not?
Well,
just let it die.
Our view would be that it would not be responsible to let it die without a replacement funding source.
Why is that?
Well, we would crash OHP Standard for starters, and
we're going to crash a lot of things.
And there would be a lot of other things that would crash with it.
And Mr. Chair, certainly we can only offer our opinion. Those are going to be decisions that you and your colleagues get to make. But I think the point we wanted to make is that we have a history now of, for the past 6 years in this state, of voluntarily taxing ourselves in order to help sustain the Medicaid program. And we think we've earned our chops in terms of demonstrating our willingness to be a part of a solution. We also understand how provider taxes work acutely well from having managed the plan for the last 6 years with our own members. And what we know from our experience is that a 4% tax won't work. We want to see something...
Won't work under what conditions?
Well, it won't work under the conditions that we have agreed to throughout the course of the last 6 years.
But what if we find a way to increase the cost of Medicaid reimbursement on your whole book of Medicaid business, not only the new ones but the old ones? What happens if we find a way to reduce your uncompensated care by half or a quarter or something?
Well, Mr. Chair, certainly we are open to all kinds of solutions. The challenge that we have is that from the way Oregon manages its Medicaid program, the only area where you pay hospitals directly is in fee-for-service.
It's a dumb way.
Well,
we can find some other way to do it.
Perhaps you can, and perhaps CMS will bless that.
What if we find a way? You're being compensated for Medicaid you have now at about 67% of cost. The governor's budget reduced that to 50-something percent of cost. What if we find a way to move that up to 80% of cost? That'd be a huge boonfall. I mean, a huge windfall. And what if we find a way to reduce the uncompensated care by a significant amount?
We're open to any proposal, and we would be pleased to model any proposal and give you our feedback. We have one proposal on the table right now, which is the governor's budget.
We've modeled that. No, we don't. We have a proposal in 2009. The governor's budget's irrelevant now. The governor's budget was written before there were two new revenue forecasts. The Ways and Means Committee have decided that they're not even looking at the governor's budget. They're looking at current service levels. The only place you have to look for a current proposal is in 2009, which has $100 million in it for increasing reimbursement to providers.
Mr. Chair, again, just to, you know, for emphasis, we're open to being part of the solution as we always have been. We just know the limitations of what we can do under the state's current hospital tax program. And what we know is that the way in which
the state's program ends in October, it's dead. So how to work under the current state's program? There, in October, if we let it go, there will be no current state's program. You understand that? And there's nothing worse, as you point out, that could happen to hospitals. The very worst scenario of anybody's models is doing nothing. So the question is, we're gonna have to do something, or we're gonna be in big trouble. What if we craft a program that increases your Medicaid revenue and reduces your uncompensated care, so that on average the hospitals break even and bring another $1 billion of federal money into the system? That's the magic money, Representative Maurer. We have a check in Washington with the state of Oregon's name on it for $1 billion. All we have to do is find $600 million to put up to go get it.
Yeah.
But that's an extra $1 billion in this system.
And, Mr. Chair, it's the same $1 billion that's been sitting there for dozens of years for us.
That's right, and the current system prevented us from getting it. We should have gone after that long ago.
Well, we're intrigued by the paradigm shift that you're describing. I don't think that we feel that we have enough detail yet to be able to model it, but we'd be glad to work with you and staff to do that.
It seems to me that's the answer. We need to look at what options there are, and we need to have, you know, you're producing a Halloween scenario to send around to give to the newspapers and to give to the members around the building, and it's a Halloween scenario that doesn't make any sense. Let's get a scenario that works.
Ultimately,
it's about asking citizens of Oregon to pay more.
It's not.
And they are going to have to approve it.
It's not about asking
citizens. We can make the decision in the building, the governor can sign it, and it's going to get referred to the voters.
But Representative Maurer,
it's palatable.
There's nothing that I'm proposing that will cost the citizens of Oregon more money. They're paying federal income tax right now. So if we collect that $1 million, it's not going to increase their federal income tax. If we can model this in a way so in a steady state time, the insurance premiums don't go up, but they go down, and the hospital revenue doesn't go down but goes up, then it seems to me we can craft a model, and I think it's feasible to do. I mean, let's not assume we can. I think we can create a model that, in fact, will not cost the citizens of Oregon anymore, but we'll bring $1 billion into the state, which is 30 jobs per million. That's a ton of jobs, and if we don't do it, we're in a catastrophe situation. There's absolutely no question what will cost the citizens of Oregon more is not doing this.
Okay,
then where is the proposal? Because the only proposal that's even been remotely proposed in a public forum has been the governor's recommended.
It's in 2009. You've read that. You've gotten all the way. Well, you maybe haven't gotten to 125 yet.
We had.
Oh, no. In 2009, you have blanks.
And the question
I'm
is.
I'm sorry.
The
blanks and, don't, is an automatic.
And we have $100 million for increasing reimbursement to the providers. And the question is, let's create models that fill in those blanks in a way that the citizens don't pay more money and that we get that $1 billion in to offset whatever costs there are. That's our, that seems to me our task, not to assume that it can't be done before we start trying to figure out how to do it.
I'm not assuming it can't be done. I'm just saying, show me.
Mr. Chair, I think we agree on a couple of things, and I want to underscore those. We agree that the zero option is not tenable. And I think we agree that we have to have a new funding mechanism.
And that the current model is not tenable either.
Yes, the current model is not tenable. And I think we agree that we have to have a replacement model that works for everybody. And I think what we're saying is we're anxious to work with anyone to come up with something that is livable and works for everyone. But we're also saying that at least what we're able to analyze around the 4% pretty clearly does not work for us. And so we're anxious to look at any alternative scenarios that we might be able to model and
come out
here with.
Have you modeled a number that doesn't include the reduced reimbursement rate that's in the governor's balanced budget?
Mr. Chairman, let me answer the question this way, because I think, I know that we've run past, but
actually we asked the building to shut off the heat, so I don't think we're going to be here very long.
just to be clear, in the program, the hospital tax program, and that we've operated for 6 years, one of the principles that hospitals have used is we want to maximize the tax to maximize the leverage of federal funds as long as the money can be returned in the aggregate to hospitals to offset their tax liability.
Well, but there is a big difference. In the current system, the original promise was every bit of tax and every bit of match goes back to the hospitals. That was a premise. It didn't turn out that way, Kevin, but that was...
Well, it was supposed to be spent on hospital services,
right?
Not to hospitals. All it right. went to the services for Medicaid enrollees.
I understand that. I think the assumption we have now is if we can tax a dollar and bring back $1.60 in federal funds, which is what we can do, we want to organize in a way that at least the dollar goes back to the hospitals. In a way, and we use the other dollar. This is the basic difference from the existing model. The basic difference is we tax a dollar, we get $1.60 from the federal government, we give you guys back the dollar paying for services for you, and we use the other $1.60 to expand coverage and do other things, which again will get to your benefit, because right now if we had 100,000 uninsured adults out of the 500,000 uninsured adults, we should be able to reduce your uncompensated care by at least 20%. And we should be able to increase your revenue, your reimbursement. So my plea to you is let's seek for a system that will do that. Can we not get there? Maybe we can't. That's the same plea that I have to the insurance company. If we put a number in that blank spot in the bill, and we create a model that ends up, after, say, 2 years, reducing their costs, not increasing their premium costs, we ought to be able to find a way to do that. I believe we can. But let's explore that. Let's get serious about that.
Mr. Chair, you have willing partners in the Hospital Association.
Yes, sir. I believe, unless I'm mistaken, we saw a model presented here last week. Mm-hmm. By the gentleman from OHSU whose name I have forgotten.
Dr. McConnell.
Thank you. And my understanding at the end of that presentation was that there was discussion going on with another group, which I believe is your group, about differences in the model, and there was going to be attempted reconciliation of the data, the underlying premises, and convergence of the models.
We've done that.
So just to follow up on that, have you modeled alternatives that include higher reimbursement rates and, you know, the kinds of things that Mr. McConnell did?
Let me answer it this way. The only way that you can increase taxes on hospitals right now and pay the money back to hospitals in the aggregate in order to not increase the cost shift is through fee-for-service payments. We've maximized what we can do. May I finish?
But that's not the only way. That's not a correct statement. That's the way it's done now.
If I could finish my statement, we've maximized the opportunity to do that. The only other option is to change the paradigm that we have around Medicaid-managed care. 80% of the Medicaid service delivery is provided through a managed care framework. So if the chair wants to explore an option where you pull hospital services out of the Medicaid managed care model and explore something that way, that's a very different paradigm. And it creates other kinds of opportunities.
Let's talk about that paradigm.
Great.
I mean, let's not assume we're doing it in a system now that we can't continue, and it doesn't work. So the question is, what we have to do is find a system that does work, that allows a way to get the money back to the hospital. I do not believe hospitals should be providing care for Medicaid members at 50% of cost. I just flat don't think that. I don't think that's appropriate.
So great point of agreement.
I don't accept that as an assumption. I think it's not appropriate, and I think it's not appropriate on the physician side. I think as long as we're not paying something closer to cost, we're not getting anybody who wants to take care of Medicaid people. And we need services for those people. So that means we need to find a way to make those reimbursement rates closer to cost. And the only way to do that is to increase the reimbursement rate.
And the only opportunity to do that is on the managed care side.
Absolutely.
That's why that is.
On the whole side.
Because I didn't understand the statement that you've maximized the ability to do this through the fee-for-service.
We are already, the under federal rule, I'm sorry, Representative Garrett, under federal rule, there is a notion, a requirement called the upper payment limit rule. And what that means, in short, is that the state can't reimburse a provider for Medicaid services at a rate or level that's higher than Medicare would pay for the same service.
We're not even close to that.
On fee-for-service, we are. On fee-for-service, which is 20%, we maximize that currently. I mean, there's a little bit of headroom, but we're very, very close to the ceiling. So that leaves the only other place where you could in effect find a way to increase rates under the upper payment limit is on the managed care side. And under the current managed care model, the state doesn't pay hospitals for services. They pay managed care plans. And so the state can raise managed care rates, but there's no way to get the money from the managed care rate
model. We right now have statutes that talk about what hospitals can charge and need to charge managed care programs. There's no reason why we can't change that statute. It's in our power to do that. It's in our power to say we're going to increase the capitation and the managed care programs need to pay hospitals at least this much. That's completely within our power.
And Mr. Chair, I think, you know, I've beat this horse to death, but we are very willing to be a part of any conversation that can find a solution. The thing that I would leave you with kind of in closing is we're actively involved with a larger group of stakeholders in developing an alternative model, and we'd like to come back and talk to you about it when we're ready. But we feel really strongly that one of the challenges with the notion of taxing hospitals to pay for Medicaid for hospital, doctor, prescription drug, durable medical equipment, all these services, is that you have a really, really narrow tax base. And we think that a social program like Medicaid should be spread across the broadest tax base possible. And so when we come back, we're going to present a model that we think addresses that more directly than the hospital tax.
And I'm saying, and I know there's that work going on to create something like a claims tax I think it's really important that you get the work done and get it to us, because we're going to have to move on this thing, and we are going to move on it. If there's an alternative we should be considering, I told your boss that yesterday. Get it to us so we can look at it.
The statement that I made earlier was lead up to, I don't see any of that model in this one, and what I was hoping was that we were going to see the result of that dialogue, and if it's in here, it's transparent to me.
It's not in there. It's that dialogue isn't complete yet.
The one area where we have, in effect, reconciled is we've come to some fairly direct agreement around what the impact of the governor's recommended budget would be under the two models. And within the reconciliation, we're within 2 to 3% of one another on the estimation of that impact.
I think we're very close. When we use the same assumptions, we're very close to getting the same
impact. And that's, I think, really hopeful.
Yeah. So now the question is to model some other things.
Yes.
So, Mr. Chair, do we have a sense of the timeline, you know, by which you'll complete your modeling and come back with some proposals?
Well, it sounds as though we have two options now.
They're creating a whole new approach. There is a leadership, as I understand it, there is a leadership group put together by the Oregon Business Council, I believe, that includes CEOs of hospitals, CEOs of insurance companies, and business leaders. And they're being staffed by three experienced people, John Lee, a past CEO of Providence, Andy Davidson, the CEO of the association, and Denise Hansel, an ex-health plan manager of Kaiser. And they're working on a proposal they're trying to perfect to come to us. Rather than dealing with the model on the table, they're trying to perfect an alternative, and I think it's important. And my understanding is the alternative would be something like a tax on all insurance claims, a transaction fee or something on all insurance claims. So we're looking forward to hearing that in a full blown. But I'm arguing in the meantime, we also need to work about could we perfect the hospital and health insurance tax in a way that will end up at least having some hope of making sense to people. So, and I'm urging them to hurry. The problem is it's not an easy thing to determine. There are a lot of questions that need to be asked when you start talking about a sales tax on health care.
Yep.
Okay, they shut off the heat, they shut off the lights. I think there's a hint here that we need to go, and I promise everybody an end at 5 o'clock on Friday, and I failed in that.
Failed miserably.
Let the record show it's 5:33 and not 5 o'clock.
Thank you.
And
thanks.
I close this informational hearing.